Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, we all know Greece is a seaside paradise, and it has countless small islands and big islands, and fishing and the sea are an intricate part of everyday life. So there are many, many delicious fish-based products that you can buy from Malbian Greek here in the UK, for you to taste the authentic seaside taste of Greece. The most amazing one, which I could recommend, is the botarga made from grey mallet by Trikalinos. Trikalinos family makes the best botarga in Greece, and it makes it exclusively from grey mallet roe, and it's the best roe used for the avgotaracho production. It's a family company, and they've been going on for 150 years, and they make this best seafood ingredient. This is something that you can use to grate over your pasta or slice it very thinly and eat it as a very luxurious meze with your tsipouro or with your raki or ouzo. Of course, you can also find other famous Greek products from the sea, like marinated sardine fillets and marinated anchovy fillets, both from Trikalinos again. Tarama salata, which is very, very popular. Sea salt, of course. Rock samphire. All these fish delicacies, smoked or marinated, they represent an essential part of the Greek traditional gastronomy. They're treated with care, without any preservatives or additives or chemical processing. And of course, all of them, they are a perfect match for ouzo, raki or tsipouro. Malbian Greek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. For all you lucky listeners of the Delicious Legacy podcast, Malbian Greek has an amazing discount, which you can claim if you go to malbiangreek.com/delicious, where you can get a 15% discount. Yep, that's right, 15% discount off your next purchase. Go forth and shop Greek. Ancient Athens, Greece, 400 BCE. A splash of garros on your food, master. We could easily imagine a slave asking a guest or his master a question like this during the dinner party at the early stages of a long-drawn symposium. On this typical lively drinking party of mostly wealthy or aristocratic Athenians is where we find one of the most unique flavoring condiments of classical Greece and Rome, called garros, or garum, or most commonly known today, physos. Here, we would find it naturally on the tables of every citizen thinking himself as a respectable member of the Athenian democracy or the Roman Republic, throwing lavish dinner parties for his guests. There are more details in a unique document from Sicily or Greece of around 400 BCE, the strange sensuous banquet of Philoxenus, a poetic celebration of obsessive culinary pleasures, a literary dinner party. water for our hands, a silver jug, a gentle child to pour it, goodly springs of slender metal, woven for wreaths. In came a pair of slaves with a shiny table, and another, until they filled the room. They fetched in snow-white barley rolls in baskets, a casserole, no, bigger than that, called a marmite, full of noble ale, with a look of the conger about him. Honey-glazed shrimps, besides, my love. Squid, sprinkled with sea salt, baby birds in flaky pastry, and a baked tuna, gods! What a huge one, fresh from the fire, and the pan and the carving knife. Enough steaks from its tender belly to delight us both as long as we might get to stay and munch. And so on this manner, the poetic description of Philoxenus continues. But what is important for our story is that on most, if not all of these dinners, the food would have had some garum in it, and the guests probably would have had a small amphora with the liquid to season their meal. So what exactly is garos, or garum as we know it now then? Garum is what we call fish sauce, and is a forgotten ingredient in Western Europe. I've read somewhere that's been described as the funky fish gut sauce that was the ketchup of the ancient world. Which, to be fair, is not too far from the truth. Garum was the ubiquitous table sauce, the go-to flavoring agent of the ancient world. Cooks used it in foods, gourmet guests used it at the table. But before we go to the history of garum, let's start our story a little bit earlier. I'm Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy podcast. Welcome to our latest episode. Today, we're going to examine the story of one of the most popular ingredients in the ancient Mediterranean world, garum, or garos in Greek, or as we would describe it today, fish sauce. Sit back and enjoy. Let's go back. Let's rewind and start our story a little bit further into the past. 5.3 million years ago, to be precise, when the Mediterranean was at her infancy. As we will hear later on, she is the central element in our story about garum. The history of the Mediterranean Sea is governed by its tectonic plates and the movement of the African plate, the Arabian plate, and the Eurasian plate. The tectonic plates shrunk the previously massive Tethys Ocean and isolated the westernmost part of it from what we call now the Atlantic Ocean, forming the Mediterranean Basin. As it was completely isolated, it took a few thousand years to almost dry up. So the Mediterranean Basin was an almost entirely dry expanse of low-lying land between 1.5 kilometers and 2.7 kilometers beneath today's sea level. So at this point, roughly 5.3 million years ago, something happened with the Straits of Gibraltar and water started moving from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. In a few years, the basin was filled again. The formation of the sea is important in our story because despite this new great expanse of water, the peoples of the Mediterranean weren't isolated, but indeed more connected. As far as seas go, the Med is relatively calm for long periods of the year and navigable with relatively small or primitive vessels. The civilizations of Europe, Asia, and North Africa all engaged in an intertwined, complex network of trade. Long before the time of Alexander the Great and the Roman Empire, we have evidence of this interconnection and the trade networks. One such example of trade networks between the different kingdoms and peoples of the Mediterranean, it can be seen at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea, just outside what is today the coast of southern Turkey. Here, archaeologists have found shipwrecks as far back as 3,600 years ago. One of the most famous ones is the Uluburu shipwreck, which We found that its cargo, tin and copper ingots, as well as jars with olives, almonds, figs, pomegranates, and other food items. We can also see the importance of the Mediterranean Sea at the naming of it by the ancient peoples. So we know the Greeks referred to it as simply the sea, or the Great Sea. The Carthaginians as the Syrian Sea, and the Romans called it Mare Nostrum, which translates in English as our sea. So from around 800 BC, the Greeks started forming colonies and dominating the trade between the Eastern Mediterranean Sea and the Black Sea and Southern Italy, where they had the main body of their colonies. And the Phoenicians, which are people who inhabited what is modern-day Syria and Lebanon, they colonized North Africa. They made the famous city of Carthage, which became a powerful player on the western half of the Mediterranean area, and went on to create more colonies and city-states across North Africa and the shores of Spain. Those two big players, the Carthaginians and the Greeks, they started trading, and we have the first recorded production of physos or garum by the ancient Greeks of the Black Sea colonies. This was around the 5th century BCE. Clearly, the abundant fish resources of the Black Sea played a role in the production of this extremely popular condiment. From the next century, so around the 4th century BC, we have evidence of the Carthaginians making physos in Cadiz, in today's Spain, which was an important trading port at the edges of the known world. Back then was called Gadir. And we have evidence of exporting of physos from Gadir to ancient Athens. So from the rise of power of ancient Athens, we go swiftly to Alexander the Great and his conquest of the Persian Empire. And from there, the doors open for the vast riches and new foods and luxuries of Asia to the Greeks of mainland Greece and southern Italy, of course. At this point, a more formal Greek cuisine emerged, which later, during the Hellenistic period, so around the 3rd century BCE, seems to have been defined around the use of garos or garum. And it is this cuisine that arrived in Rome in the 2nd century BC, and when the Roman elites fell under the spell of the Greek dining culture. This most likely happened, the whole idea and the whole cuisine was transferred wholesale with the use of Greek cooks by the Roman elites. So we see physos was really important to the Carthaginians, to the Greeks, and to the Romans themselves. And as an example of the supreme popularity and fashion status of garum in the Roman Empire, we have the words of Martial, a Roman poet from Hispania, which is modern-day Spain, who lived between 38 AD and 102 AD, and he's best known for his 12 books of epigrams, which are short, witty poems that cheerfully satirize the city life. We know from his verse what he says about garum, written to accompany a little present of a jar of garum. Here is lordly garum, a costly gift, made from the first blood of still gasping mackerel. So from this verse, it's almost certain that garum was a table condiment and was made from the blood and viscera of very fresh fish. Sometimes this was handled by the diner himself and used in relatively small amounts of already cooked food. The other more commonplace kind of sauce was called liquamen and was used in the kitchen by the cook to add salt and other more complex flavors to most dishes, just as we add salt or soy sauce or Worcestershire sauce during cooking. So this liquamen was made using various kinds of whole small fish, which were then mixed with salt and left to dissolve and ferment for up to 3 months in the hot Mediterranean sun. The resulting liquefied fish was removed from his bone and it was shipped all across the Mediterranean in special amphorae. This whole fish sauce is very similar to the Thai fish sauce, is so popular today. And on that note, I would like to add that the Roman fish sauce, the Greek and Roman fish sauce, was nothing like the modern day anchovy paste. Using the latter, it's been the downfall of many attempts to recreate ancient recipes. So fish sauce was manufactured at factory sites along the coast. Obviously, you want them to be near the ports, near the fishing ports, so you have the freshest fish. These were typically beside a beach or a harbour. The fish was only a few hours from the net when the process began, and basically as far as away from the towns, because the whole process stinks quite a lot, as you would imagine. These sauces are not a rotten, decaying substance. That's the important distinction we have to make here. What took place was not bacterial putrefaction, which, given the high proportion of salt, would be impossible, but enzymic proteolysis, a process in which the enzymes in the viscera of the fish convert the solid protein into a liquid form. So the viscera is therefore essential to the process. Without them, the protein does not dissolve. Now, you and I, the modern gourmands, we probably understand and know too well from our modern experience, there wasn't going to be one product called fish sauce and fit every single occasion. As always, there was an elite one for commoners, and many, many other versions in between. We know one called Muria, which was garum made from fish that they were gutted and had their heads removed. We know of hemation, a fermented product that consisted of nothing but the guts and blood of fish, and it was made as a byproduct of the fisheries. We also have, for example, when Martial describes his sauce being made from blood of a still-breathing mackerel, that this implies that it was a black and bloody sauce. Or we have surviving Greek recipes for fish sauce that also affirm the importance of the distinction between blood viscera sauce and one made from whole fish. As you can see, things can get a little bit complicated when we muddle through the murky waters of ancient gastronomy. One could buy aged elite black mackerel garum, ordinary black tuna garum, elite liquamen cooking sauces made from mackerel, or cheaper cooking sauces made with a smaller fish, or a tuna or mackerel muria, both of which could also be aged or new. All of these products could also come in second or even third grade versions. Aged elite black mackerel garum, the expensive table condiment sauce, would be lost in the cooking process and wasted. Therefore, it needed to be seen by the gourmet and to be experienced, valued, and discussed. We can conclude it would have been the table sauces handled by the guests or the host himself. In Roman cuisine, the use of garum was enriched with different combinations of the sauce. So we have garum with wine, called inogarum, with honey, meligarum, with vinegar, oxigarum, with water, hydrogarum, or with dry spices, such as dill, oregano, coriander, celery, or even mint. These sauces were used as condiments for literally everything, from meat and fish to vegetables, salads, desserts, bread, and wine dipping. The Greek physician, who was the most prolific medical writer and who influenced medieval medicine more than any other, was Galen of Pergamon of the 2nd century AD, as we've seen on our previous episode. Galen's use of fish sauce in his treatise on food and diet is valuable, as there are numerous references to what we now know is a simple whole fish garros, which is blended with wine or vinegar and oil as a simple dressing for vegetables. Lettuce, for instance, is boiled in the winter and served with olive oil, garros, and vinegar, while mallow and cabbage are served with olive oil and garros in order to ease the passage through the body. For the Romans, the best garum was the same color as the amber Falernian wine. A famous and well-known name in ancient fish sauce was garum sociorum, or the partner's garum, mentioned several times in literature, and also one that has been evoked on amphorae inscriptions. This was the garum in which our favorite ancient gourmand, Apicius, prescribed that the red mullet should be drowned in. So basically one of his recipes was red mullet, which would be cooked in generous and copious amount of fish sauce. From the amazing book of Sally Granger's The Classical Cookbook, the best way to use garum in all recipes is the following. Take a liter of grape juice and reduce it by half. Let it cool and blend a bottle of Thai Nam Pla fish sauce with it. Once you have that table condiment, you can use it in a recipe called honey glazed prawns with oregano and black pepper. It's a relatively simple dish, and I made countless times at home for friends or in parties, dinner parties, or in some themed ancient Greek dinners. And I've done it as a starter, and it's relatively easy. So for a decent starter for two, take 8 large prawns, 15 milliliters of olive oil, 30 milliliters of fish sauce, 30 grams of clear honey, a handful of chopped fresh oregano and black pepper. Place the oil, fish sauce and honey in a saucepan, then add the prawns. Sauté gently in the cooking liquor for about 3 minutes. Remove the prawns, keep them somewhere warm, and let the sauce cook a little bit more until it reduces by half. Then add oregano, pour over the prawns and sprinkle liberally with fresh ground black pepper. Serve with crusty bread and some green salad. Similarly, we can make homemade smoked sausages from a recipe of the Book of Apicius, which includes a minced pork belly, pine nuts, a herb called rue, which we talked on a previous episode, peppercorns, savory, cumin, bay berries, fresh parsley, and then we can simply grill the sausages on the barbecue or in our oven. There is something very interesting from the ancient world as well, which is a vegetarian version of garum. So, a liquamen from pears. And this is made, according to Palladius, like this, with very ripe pears, which they are trodden with salt that has not been crushed. When their flesh has broken down, store it either in small casks or in earthenware vessels lined with pitch. When it's hung up to drain, after the third month without being pressed on, the flesh of the pears discharges a liquid with a delicious taste but a pastel color. To counter this, mix in a production of dark-colored wine when you salt the pears. A little bit insane recipe, isn't it? So for certain purposes, perhaps for rituals or for vegetarians, I would guess, there was something like a garum, but made from pears, a vegetarian garum, which is a very interesting fact. Someone should try that. But what happened to garum? How did it disappear from our cuisine? It is certainly a lost and unknown ingredient in the Western Europe. Countless times people said that they have rediscovered it somewhere in some far-flung corner of the Mediterranean, but every time that seems to be a myth. What we know so far is that it was in use in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, what we call now the Byzantine Empire. So at the time of the Byzantium, it was still produced in Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul, and it was eaten at the palace in dishes like with a roast kid or pork and so on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Full-scale recipes of garum supplied in the Byzantine Geoponica. These recipes are unattributed, but probably, like most of the rest of the collection, derive from sources of the Roman imperial period. The Geoponica is one of a series of compilations of earlier Greco-Roman literature commissioned by the Byzantine emperor Constantine VII, Porphyrogenitus, who was ruler 1913 until 1959, so we're talking about the 10th century of our common era. This literature was dealing with agronomy, agriculture, and other subjects of interest to farmers, but also included subjects such as astronomy, meteorology, and methods of controlling pests and warding off bad weather. Because of its encyclopedic scope, it is an invaluable source of information on many lost Greek and Latin agricultural works from the classical era. And it demonstrates the continuing vitality of late antique agronomy. More than 40 authors are cited as sources, but it depends most heavily upon the 4th century AD agronomist Vindonius Anatolius of Beirut and Cassianus Bassus, who seem to have farmed in Bithynia in the 6th or 7th century AD, and he is named in some manuscripts as the author. We have a very entertaining account from Liutprand of Cremona, who was a bishop and a diplomat. So by the year 1968 AD, he reports from Constantinople with writings of another very unpleasant liquid made from fish. This is by now, obviously, it seems to be dead in the Western Europe, in the Western Mediterranean, and clearly, in order to mourn and diminish the importance of the Byzantines, clearly he made it sound like some awful, unpleasant sauce. After the fall of the Byzantine Empire, we kind of lose track of garum. But by the year 1553, we have the last appearance of garus on a written account. And this was by the French naturalist Pierre Bellon on his book Observations. Here he tells us that it's still made at the fishing ports of Constantinople, and it's a very popular condiment. Of course, clearly, it fell out of favor later on at the Ottoman Palace. So from then onwards, we lose any track or mention of garum. So apparently, there is the last vestige of garum in Europe, which is a rare Italian sauce called, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, Collatura di Alici, traditionally made in the small fishing village of Cetara. And I think that's in the province of Salerno. Now, the sauce in Cetara, in Italy, the fish sauce of Cetara obviously has very ancient origins, but the fishermen there, they still make it, as we said. And it's a recipe that probably started from the mid-13th century. Apparently, what the local people say is that the monks who preached in the rectory of San Pietro in Tuscolo, a hill near Amalfi, they were the first who began to work in the sauce. Among their activities, there was also fishing, which took place in the summer months, aboard a modest fleet that in the winter was transformed into means of transporting wheat. So after fishing the anchovies, these were cleaned and the heads removed and the entrails removed, and they were arranged in layers with coarse salt in large wooden barrels. A heavy boulder was placed on top of this to act as a press. The excess liquid that was deposited and dripped from the bottom was so fragrant that the monks decided to collect it and take it to the kitchen. The monk who was in charge of preparing the meals decided to season boiled vegetables, adding some spices, herbs and oil. The success was immediate, and the monks sent some of the amber liquid as a gift to the inhabitants of the neighborhood villages and to other convents. Everyone began to work hard to produce it at home, until someone came up with the brilliant idea of using the same cup that was used to separate the wine from the must, to filter the sauce and make it clearer. And this is how the precious Settara fish sauce was born. According to local guides and local myths and legends, of course. So the process, this procedure for the preparation of the sauce is quite long and laborious. As anticipated, with the period for anchovy fishing between the end of March and the beginning of July, it happens around there. The best anchovies are fished in May, and after fishing they are cleaned, as we said earlier, strictly by hand. For about 12 hours, these anchovies are left to rest in a container with a mixture of water and salt. This is only the first part of the procedure. Then they are arranged in layers with coarse salt in oak barrels called tergini, whose dimensions are one-third of a classic barrel. The barrels are closed with a wooden lid on which large stones are placed. During the first 48 hours, they exert more pressure, and then one can lighten the weight. The pressing liquid that emerges on the surface is the basic one of the preparation. Towards the end of October, the anchovy sauce is almost ready for the last stage of preparation. The liquid collected and set aside is poured into the terzino, where the anchovies were macerated, and while it crosses the layers, it collects all the nutrients through the vriale, a hole made on the terzino. Then it is recovered and then transferred to a container. The last phase involves filtering the liquid with linen cloths and letting this anchovy sauce rest on the windowsill in special glass bottles. Before closing with a cork, place a bunch of oregano, which is there to flavor the colatura. And this, my friends, that's how they make colatura di Alice Settara in the Amalfi Coast nowadays. A very interesting sauce, which I've tried it, of course. I buy it quite often, and it's really, really tasty. Definitely something you should use. And there are recipes from the area that you can find, which I will post on Patreon, on how to use it. Some recent archaeological discoveries down in Andalusia, near Cadiz, in an area called Bologna, there are ruins of a Roman city of Baello Claudia, which was built on the 2nd century BC. Researchers of the University of Cadiz and the archaeological ensemble of Baello Claudia have discovered two complete Roman salazzone factories named Cetaria in an excellent state of conservation in Baello Claudia. It's the first time that organic remnants of salted tuna have been discovered thanks to the discovery of skins in some of these pools of the salazzone factories. Likewise, in these places, in this city, they found also garum factories, and these have been studied, and the residues of its manufacture are still there, still intact, and at the base of some of the amphoras. And so several members of the Department of the Chemical Engineering of the University of Cadiz decided to enter the world of gastronomy based on these findings. So they made something. So they made a garum, recreated the garum. So together with a group of archaeologists, which they found solid and well-preserved remains of garum in Pompeii, brought together clues of how to create garum. Great dose of combination and patience was acquired, and they made this beautiful amber green brown sauce of the ancient Mediterranean, which in its heyday, the price would be equivalent to 600 euros per liter. All of which brings us to the modern Thai or Vietnamese fish sauce, which is a very handy ingredient in our kitchen arsenal. I think it should be used more often and in a lot of different dishes. And if we take inspiration from the Book of Apicius, which has hundreds of recipes using garum, we can clearly see that it was not only important back then, but it can be important now as well, and not playing a starring role, but to be there just under the surface, impregnating the dishes with an intangible magic, focusing and waking up the natural flavors of the ingredients. Once we do that, we can definitely taste the depth and the umami of the garum in our dishes, and they are tasting like a hyped up versions of themselves. From modern Southeast Asian cuisine, we learn of a fermented squid blood viscera sauce that is used today in Japanese cuisine. It is known as ishiri and is used as a finishing sauce for sushi as well as cooked foods. I will post some pictures of that on my Patreon so you know that you can find it. So this particular sauce, that fish sauce, it tastes neither fishy nor salty and smells of the iron compounds from the blood. In the Japanese cuisine, there is also a whole fish sauce called ishiru, and many dishes are prepared with both. So, for example, the whole fish sauce is used for cooking, and the blood viscera sauce finishes the dish. This sauce is truly fermented with bacteria and low salt. I found some of the ishiru sauce in some Japanese supermarket in London, and I can testify that it's really tasty. It has almost a smoky flavor in a sense, and yeah, you can definitely taste the iron compounds in a way, and it definitely doesn't smell fishy, doesn't have the intense smell of the fish sauce we know from the Vietnamese cuisine. Now, the most weird thing here is that the Japanese word for viscera is gari. So what are the chances? It would be rather interesting to draw a link between the ancient Roman garum and Thai fish sauces on this point. But there aren't many references in historical documents from the region before the 7th century that mention them. Also, we know as a highly valuable commodity for the Romans, and given its portability, it's fun to imagine a connection and lineage between the two vastly disparate cooking styles. But in all probability, these sauces were developed independently. Credits and sources for more information regarding today's episode. The Uluburun Shipwreck, which you can find more information about it on Wikipedia or at the excellent podcast called the Maritime History Podcast. And also from the Fall of Civilizations podcast, the book Siren Feasts, History of Food and Gastronomy in Greece by Andrew Dalby, the Classical Cookbook by Andrew Dalby again and Sally Granger, the Zanclean Flood about the formation of the Mediterranean Sea. I would like also to mention the 3rd century book The Dipnosophiste by Athenaeus that helped us by providing vast amounts of information from that era. Also the book of the world-famous Noma restaurant, The Noma Guide to Fermentation, where they provide recipes to make the ancient garum, but also garum made by beef or squid or roasted chicken wings, amongst other things. Incredible. Check it out if you haven't. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. And remember, if you liked what you heard, please subscribe on my Patreon page and help me create interesting archaeogastronomic podcasts. Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.